Welcome to the Nightly Five podcast with Ben O'Shea.
On today's show, counter-terrorism raids in New South Wales, I'll tell you why, and yet another death of a woman in Australia, allegedly at the hands of a man in her life. Plus, the Woodside AGM today was a feisty affair, and a medical expert will join me soon with a warning about weight loss drug Ozempic and women getting pregnant. And we'll end the show today by remembering rugby league great Terry Hill, whose death at 52 has shocked the NRL. In our top story today, counter-terrorism raids in New South Wales.
The Joint Counter-Terrorism Team is executing search warrants across Sydney as part of investigations into riots outside a church where someone was stabbed at Wakeley.
As ASIO Director-General Mike Burgess and AFP Commissioner Rhys Kershaw addressed the National Press Club today, counter-terrorism raids were being conducted in New South Wales. The New South Wales Police Joint Terrorism Team today executed search warrants across Sydney as part of what it said was an ongoing investigation. It's understood the warrants are in relation to the Wakeley Church stabbing. As we know, a 16-year-old boy has been charged with a terrorism offence over the alleged stabbing of Bishop Mari Emanuel during a service at the Christ the Good Shepherd Church last Monday night. Following that incident, a riot broke out outside the church after hundreds of people gathered, and New South Wales Police said more than 50 officers in attendance were injured. Speaking about the counter-terrorism raids today, New South Wales Police said there is no current threat to public safety and no connection to Anzac Day commemorations happening tomorrow. ASIO boss Mike Burgess was asked about the raids when he took questions at the press club. He said ASIO was involved in the raids being carried out in Sydney today as a member of the Joint Counter-Terrorism Team. He also said his officers are connected and involved and embedded inside the Joint Counter-Terrorism Team and on the back end. Australia's security services are always providing security intelligence that enables the police to deal with these problems when they have immediate threats to life or any other situation that's evolving.
Over the course of this year, where we have seen too many women already in 2024 lose their life. They've lost their life either at the hands of a current or former partner, or they've lost their life at the hands of a complete stranger who seemed intent on inflicting harm against women. This has to stop.
Victorian homicide detectives are investigating the death of a woman after her body was discovered in the state's north on Tuesday. Emergency services were called to an address on Campbell Road in Cobram, near the border between Victoria and New South Wales, at about 2:15pm. A 39-year-old Cobram man, who officers believe knew the woman, was assisting investigators with their inquiries. Victorian Premier Jacinta Allan told reporters today that it was difficult for her to comment in terms of this particular incident. But she said that in the broader context, over the course of this year, she's seen too many women already this year lose their life. The death comes days after 28-year-old mother Molly Ticehurst was found dead in her central New South Wales home. Today, New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has launched an urgent review to determine if it should reform bail laws related to domestic violence after Molly's alleged murderer was released on bail on a slew of serious charges in the days before her death. Her former partner, Daniel Billings, was on bail, having been accused of raping and stalking her in the months before the killing. Min said the system had let Molly Ticehurst down. Let's hear what the Premier had to say today.
I can inform you all that the government today via the Attorney General will be making a formal referral to the Crown Advocate David Kell SC, seeking urgent advice in relation to this matter for the government to determine whether urgent law reform is required in relation to bail laws in the state, particularly as they relate to domestic violence offences in New South Wales.
His advice to the AG will also relate to decisions made in the lead-up to Molly Ticehurst's death.
Some of Australia's biggest environmental advocacy groups are gathered outside the Crown Casino here today, where Woodside's annual general meeting is taking place.
Yes, that was the scene outside the Woodside AGM that happened in Perth today. Inside, Woodside Chair Richard Goyder was re-elected to the board after defending a push from shareholders who sought to remove him over the company's climate credentials. Here with more is someone who was there in person, up late host Ben Harvey. Harves, I hear it was a pretty feisty AGM today.
Well, the protest action wasn't limited to outside Crown Perth. They actually managed to get through about 200 different security staff. They're like ninjas. judges, these protesters. And about two-thirds of the way through the AGM, about a dozen people stood up very close to the front and started singing Crowded House's Hey Now, a butchered version, that they'd inserted words about climate action, climate change, etc., etc. They stood there singing for about 2 minutes while Richard Goyder tried to pretend it wasn't happening.
It was quite
embarrassing to experience.
Funnily enough, Neil Finn just sold his back catalogue to some private equity mob, so I wonder if that private equity mob will be coming after these protesters. And so Richard Goyder, as I mentioned, saw off a challenge and retained his role as chair of Woodside. Was it much of a challenge in the end?
It was. He got through reasonably comfortably in the end, but when you're the chair of the company, you really want to have more than 90% of people behind you, and he doesn't have that. So he's probably on life support at the moment. Not that he really cares, because he's only got a couple more years to go, and then he's going to naturally leave the company anyway. The thing that Richard will not miss at all at AGMs is not just people protesting, and there were two separate protests today. It's the fact that anyone who owns one share of Woodside can go to the AGM. So one share in Woodside at the moment is about $28.50 or thereabouts. So for $28.50, you can go to Crown, free parking, waltz in. You probably eat $50 worth of buffet food on the way through, because they put the Bain Marie's out for shareholders. And then you can ask any question you want of the Woodside CEO or the Woodside chairman. And most of the questions were not about Woodside. They were about everything from, I made some notes here, Mr. Chang, long-term shareholder, appalled that he arrived 20 minutes early but was still 10 minutes late to sit down because of the security. And he said he was particularly upset with the fact that you could not bring a bag that was larger than A4 into the foyer, because the magazines that they were given were larger than A4, and therefore he couldn't get it into his bag. And Mr. Chang spoke about this for about 7.5 minutes.
Wow. And I'm sure that sounds like an issue that was probably really quite influential on his share portfolio.
Yeah,
so that's a good use of everybody's time at the AGM.
He probably bought those shares for about 12 cents and they're worth $28 now. So Mr. Chang can afford as many bags as he wants.
Was there any curly questions that were remotely relevant to the businesses of Woodside?
There were a lot of people, not so much on the core business, as in, are you confident that the Senegal deal is going to be earnings accretive, as they say, and that kind of stuff. It was more people saying, I'm copping a lot of grief around the dining room table at the moment about climate change, and can you just make it so that I can look my kids in the eye? It was a lot of talk about whether or not Woodside should have better catering at the AGM. It was a lot of talk about people that were quite rightfully talking about Burrup rock art, but they clearly didn't have any idea about the intricacies of it. One woman stood up and said, have you considered spraying something over the rock art? Sort of like a go down to Bunnings
like
and get
varnish.
Yes, just nail varnish over the top, and surely that would protect it. And Richard, to his credit, with every one of these increasingly stupider and stupider questions, had to nod sagely and say, we'll look into it.
Yeah, good on him. Well, he's the man in the chair for the time being. We'll see what happens over the next few years. And as always, thank you to Up Late host Ben Harvey for joining us on the Nightly Five.
Thanks, Ben.
Ozempic lowers the risk of major cardiovascular events such as stroke, heart attack or death in adults also with known heart disease. And you may lose weight.
Yes, you may lose weight on Ozempic, but that's not the only potential outcome. Stories are emerging of women getting pregnant, in most cases unintentionally, while taking the trendy weight loss medication, despite being on birth control or dealing with years of fertility issues. So is Ozempic making women more fertile? And what does the drug do to unborn babies? Here to help us understand that is Emeritus Professor of Reproductive and Periconceptual Medicine at the University of Adelaide, Professor Rob Norman. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ben.
So is there evidence to suggest Ozempic is making women more fertile? What's going on here?
So, Ben, it's really important to recognise that it's not going to help the average person get pregnant. What it could do is by losing weight, people who are not having regular periods, who are not producing eggs regularly, what we call lack of ovulation, they can start suddenly having periods again. And this is because we know that being overweight impacts the ability of a woman's body to ovulate and to produce eggs. And you need eggs to get babies. So in a group of people who are overweight, not having regular periods, who might have a condition called polycystic ovary syndrome, Ozempic, through its rapid weight loss, could suddenly help people to get pregnant.
Mm. And so in the US, there have been some questions asked about whether it should be prescribed in those situations because of the potential risk it might have on an unborn fetus. What do we know about those risks?
So the advice that we as doctors have always given to patients in the situation is that they should do lifestyle change, exercise, trying to reduce the calories and to lose weight. Now, we know that this doesn't work very well with diet and exercise, or if it does, it takes a long time. So people are using Ozempic to try and get rapid weight loss. So you do it in a couple of months. Initial animal studies were very negative about the impact on a baby that was going to be born in animals. And there was a lot of concern about abnormalities in these animals. And so all the advice is that you should not get pregnant while you're on this group of drugs. However, there has been a paper published recently looking at patients who are diabetic, which is the main reason for using it clinically, and looking at people who were on this drug and inadvertently got pregnant, and they weren't able to show an increased rate of abnormalities compared to women who were diabetic who were not on the drug. So at the moment, we're not overly concerned, but we still are giving people advice that they ought to stop this drug at least 2 months before they try and get pregnant.
Mm. And like, I think back to a situation like the thalidomide epidemic that was a drug that people thought was safe, and then it caused these horrific abnormalities, and we only realized afterwards what was going on. Is there any chance that Ozempic could be something that we look back on in the same way, or is the level of, analysis and examination around it much better and the awareness much better?
I think you're totally right, Ben, to be concerned. So there are a group of drugs we know people should not be taking when they're trying to get pregnant. So, for instance, some anti-epileptic drugs are definitely proven to have bad effects. And the fact that we can get rapid weight loss, that this is really convenient and that people start to get pregnant quickly, is not a good excuse for people to use it to try and get pregnant this way. And we've got a lot of evidence that what happens to an embryo and to a developing fetus in the womb has an impact for the rest of their life. And so I don't think that anyone should be advocating using this drug to help get pregnant. Mm. My recommendation would be that if lifestyle change is not working, that in combination with a doctor, people could go on to this drug, but using contraception, and then probably stopping it about 2 months before trying to get pregnant. One of the problems is when you stop this drug, you tend to put on weight very rapidly. So there needs to be some organization whereby you still keep your diet and exercise under control.
Mm.
So really, I think for women and couples who are planning pregnancy, this may have a role, but please don't use it when you're actively trying to get pregnant.
And what's your advice for women who are taking Ozempic currently and then find themselves pregnant?
Well, the current contraceptive methods are still very effective. So although there's been some evidence that being on the oral contraceptive may not work quite as well with Ozempic, I'm not overly worried by that. So I think people should be using, the woman should be using oral contraception or an intrauterine device. The man could be using a condom. And there's no real evidence that Ozempic is undoing that effect at all.
Better to be safe than sorry, I think, is the message here. Emeritus Professor of Reproductive and Periconceptual Medicine at the University of Adelaide, Professor Rob Norman, really appreciate your time and sharing these insights on the Nightly Five.
Thanks, Ben.
Cult hero of rugby league, Terry Hill, has died overseas. Hill, who played nearly 250 games for six clubs, winning the 1996 grand final with Manly, has reportedly died in the Philippines after suffering a heart attack. He was just 52 years old. Here with more is Nightly Sports editor Ben McClellan. Ben, you're a Manly man. Mm. What are your fondest memories of Terry Hill as a player?
Look, he was just a tenacious centre. He was. If there was ever a scrap, he was the first one in, and he played during an era of rugby league when you know fights were fights and men were men. So, look, he was ferocious as he was funny. So he was just always in it. He was the leading try scorer in 1997 during the height of the sort of ARL News Corp Super League war, where there were two rival competitions. He was also quite a character. He was a regular on the footy show, loved his greyhounds. He was big at the Dapto Dogs, which our New South Wales listeners will know a lot about. Greyhounds, the greyhound industry has put out a statement saying not only was he this, you know, rugby league great, but he was also, you know, a big part of the greyhound industry. And he was very active with them. Look, you know, he played in one of the great Manly teams during a great period of rugby league. He played 14 origins for New South Wales. He was part of a very, very famous dust-up with Gordon Tallis, where they, you know, literally were face to face. There'll be a lot more said and done by people who obviously know Terry a lot better than I do, but a lot of his former teammates have already come out saying that, you know, he's always the life of the party. He was just a good bloke. We still don't know a lot of details about what's happened other than he suffered a heart attack. He was married to a local woman in the Philippines and understandably spent a fair bit of time there. He was, you know, raising money for a local orphanage, according to a report, and was with another great rugby league player of the 80s or the 90s, David Gillespie, who played with him at Wests, who just said it was a shock.
Mm. Yeah, definitely a shock. He also did some fantastic work for Lowe's menswear.
Yes.
Menswear.
How can I forget
the ads that he did? With
Zero from memory.
Yeah, exactly. And Block of Roach, I think, maybe made an appearance there for Lowe's as well. He was never, you know, the most gifted rugby league player, but he was hard at it. And in the centres, he always seemed to be at the right spot, at the right time, and he knew how to find the try line.
As they say.
He knew how to sniff out the try line, no doubt about that. Terry Hill will be missed, and we'll look to see those tributes flowing in the days to come. Nightly Sports Editor Ben McClellan, thanks for joining me on the show. And that, folks, is the show today. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and join me tomorrow on the Nightly Five.
The Nightly Five podcast is brought to you by Seven West Media. For all these stories and more, head to thenightly.com.au, helping you get in front of tomorrow.